listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio, broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on this beautiful August day. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And talk about solar-powered. It is a glorious day today. A few fluffy clouds and just one of those days, and the breeze. Oh, my gosh. Couldn't be nicer.
It's a great day to ride a bike, except I was riding into the wind this morning, and that actually, there was actually quite a bit of breeze. So
yes, that
was a little bit of a strain. But here we are.
A little exercise.
And the last 2 weeks I have spent in Austin, Texas, in 105-degree weather most of the time. And interestingly enough, our book today is partially set in Austin, Texas as well.
Yes, and it is it's an interesting book. It really is. It was an easy read. You know, you get started and, oh, gosh, I got to see what's going on, so I have to put it down. And it's the title is Almost Paradise by Corabel Schaffner. And Corabel is a wife, mother, former attorney, and author. And she graduated from Columbia University and was in law review at Vanderbilt University Law School. Her shorter work has appeared or is forthcoming in Willow Review, Word Riot, Habersham Review, Hawaii Review, Southwester, South Carolina Review, South Dakota Review, and Xavier Review. Almost Paradise is her first novel, and I hope that she does some more because it really was good.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Corabel.
Hi, thank you. And thank you, Caroline, for saying such a nice thing.
Well, I really enjoyed this. I really enjoyed this.
Now, Almost Paradise is being billed as a book for middle readers. Which is, what age group is that?
Well, I think that these age groupings are curious. Different publishing houses do different things. They're saying 10 to 12, and some others are saying 10 years to 12 years old, but others are saying 10 and older. The fact is that I didn't write this book with any genre in mind. I just wrote the best story that I could. And to tell you the truth, I thought it was going to be Pulitzer Prize-winning artistic masterpiece, but Farrar, Straus, and Giroux are the ones that told me it was for 10-year-olds. So I am very happy to end up in that group because the kidlet world is one of my favorite groups of people on Earth now that I know them.
Now, Corabel, your bio is pretty impressive. Columbia University, Law Review at Vanderbilt, but I heard that you took a somewhat not-so-straight path to get there. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background?
Yes, I'll tell you a little story. One of my children was walking through the living room with one of his best friends. They were late teens, and I suspect they were thinking about college, so they must have been seniors, and he says to my husband, Martin, and me, as he strides through, "Hey, guys, what do you think about a gap year?" And my husband, who's so stable and has always just marched, he was a grown-up. He was born when he was, he was just always grown-up. And he says, "Well, I don't know about that." And I said, "Oh, a gap year, what good is that? Take a gap decade." And as they exited the room without even pausing, he leans over to his best friend and says, "And that's the difference in my parents."
So
I am the woman who other mothers come to when their children either don't go to college or don't do anything in a linear order, and they want me to tell them
it's all going to be all right.
Then it's all going to be all right, and I'm really not the role model for that. It was all right for me, but you wouldn't want to take advice from a harebrained teenager that like I was. And I did, in fact, drop out of high school and hitchhiked away and just went all over the world. I even got on a boat and went around the world, and then came back, lived up in Vermont because I'd never been in a place that had that much snow. I was raised in Mississippi. I now live in Tennessee, and snow was just an occasional wonder. I tell you, a year and a half or 2 years in Vermont, you know, it just, you can't believe that snow comes early and stays late, and it's always there to make snowmen and snowballs, and I loved it. I really, really loved it. But in Vermont, I started doing theater, and from that, I moved to New York City, and after I had done that for a few years, I decided that I needed to do something else. This is my late 20s. It wasn't really so much a decision as a sort of what I need to do something. And my mother had always said that she'd try not to worry about me with all this wandering around if I would finish college one day. And it wasn't a big deal when she said it, but I heard it. Put it on the shelf of my brain. So when I was looking at my place in life at this particular time, and I can't tell you how wonderful living in New York was, but it just seemed time, really time, to do something else. Well, I had been a terrible student, and I dropped out of high school. I had never taken a standardized test, none of the normal things, but I marched up to Columbia University and in Manhattan, which is an Ivy League school, and begged my way in. And
how do you do that?
I really don't know. I really don't know how I've done anything. I don't know how I got to Columbia. I don't know how I married the right man. I don't know how I published this book. These big things that you just, I go and go and go and go. But I guess first thing is I didn't know that I was fool enough not to know that a place like Columbia wouldn't take me.
Mm.
And so I'm standing there, and I remember telling them things like that I had this window of opportunity was opening. I could go through it or not, and if they didn't take me and let me go through that window and become an intelligent person, which I knew was going to happen, then I would be a waitress for the rest of my life with bunions and tired and kind of, you know, just, I was never a good waitress. Some of my friends were really great waitresses. I was not. And so I just told them that it was their choice to let me become a different kind of person, and next thing I knew, I was in, and I think they were kidding me or something, but they did let me in. They gave me some life credits. They said I was mathematically illiterate, so I took a remedial course, and then I graduated with honors, because then I was telling them the truth. I was about to be smart, and I needed to do that. I wasn't smart before that.
And what did you major in?
Honors.
Hmm? What did you major in?
English literature and Arabic.
Why Arabic?
Well, because I didn't have any foreign languages, and I wanted to learn a language with a different alphabet.
Wow.
I didn't. So Chinese, I think, was an option. But really, it's a beautiful looking language written.
Oh, yeah.
So I may have just done that. I just picked it on site, and also it was. I just thought it was great to learn something that's way out there, since I'd already missed my opportunity to do Spanish and French in high school.
Wow! Now, most of us think of being smart or being intelligent as something that you're just born with and stuck with for the rest of your life. But you make it sound like it's something that you can change.
Absolutely.
So, then you went to law school. Did you go straight out of college, or were there some more twists
and turns? No, well, sort of. I met Martin, my husband, and married him. I graduated and married him pretty quickly after that. And we stayed in New York for 1 year, but I had started the process of applying to law schools. Mm-hmm. And we thought that Tennessee would be a good place. Martin's family is from near here. I'm from Mississippi. It made sense to raise a family here in Nashville. So I went to Vanderbilt Law School.
Wow. And have you practiced as an attorney?
Yes, I practiced quite a bit. And I wrote, I did a lot of legal writing. Mm. But I joined a very large law firm, large for Nashville, and it was a wonderful job. The people were great. It's a little corporate, if I might say, these are good jobs. They're good paying jobs. The people were wonderful. But the work itself, I think that if I were to do it again today, I would use it in use my law degree in other ways. Mm-hmm. But what I liked best about the work was reading law, writing briefs. That was always fun for me. I was kind of conflict averse, so I found out I really didn't like to argue, and I could have probably thought of that before going to law school. But
probably,
where you're all talking about, all your day is split up into billable hours, and I started thinking of kids' birthday parties as 2.6 billable hours, and I didn't like that. But I love the law, and I love the people I worked with. The case that I loved best of all, had to do with obstetrical malpractice in Saudi Arabia. And that went on for quite a while, and I loved it. I loved the drama of it, and I loved researching that and putting that case together. And after that, when I had a statute of limitations or something from a investment banking firm, it was just paled by comparison. And so I started to wander on to other things, but I kept writing. I did a lot of legal writing. I wrote the healthcare newsletter. I wrote a lot of briefs. I even wrote a brief that went to the Supreme Court of the United States. So, yes, I did practice, but a large corporate law firm was not the place for me in the long run.
Did your knowledge of Arab help in that case? In the Saudi Arabian.
Oh, I'd already forgotten it all.
Oh. Oh, come on.
But it helped my enthusiasm for the project. Because when I would look at the hospital and the diagram and the people and the Bedouins and all the stuff that was happening, it was very, very exciting for me to see the culture. But no, it didn't help. It didn't help. I wish I could remember things more than a couple of years. Well, it went out the window.
Well, being able to understand the culture in that scenario was really, really helpful, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Yes, it was, because there was a lot of royal family and Bedouin distinctions mm-hmm. that were just cruel some unnamed party was treating the royal family much better than the Bedouins.
Mm.
And to tell you the truth, the royal family didn't like that at all.
Oh, really?
It's their people.
Oh.
And the other wonderful thing is, particularly with the Bedouins, if one person was in the hospital, all 40 of them would come in and sit in the hall.
I'll bet the hospital liked that.
You know, I always wonder when I watch hospital shows on TV, why the patients hardly ever have people there. You know, there may be one person or sometimes none at all. It's like, where are all their people?
Their families, you mean.
Yeah, yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Korabel Schaffner, author of Almost Paradise. So is this your first novel?
It is my first published novel. I have novels all over my house. In drawers. I have essays all over my house, short stories. I do write quite a bit. And some of my earlier novels were pretty copycat, but that was just a way of learning. You know, like a mystery or a romance or whatever. I would write, and it wasn't until this one that I wrote something that I want to publish.
So did you try and publish any of the others?
In sporadic fits and starts back in the 90s, I would write something and try to go out to do something with it, but I would always get tangled up in myself, which was a sign that it wasn't supposed to be.
Ah.
Whereas this one went through more or less normally. I mean, some people get snatched up and published on day one, and some people don't ever get published. And I was had a very normal writer's experience with this book because I learned very, very studiously how to approach agents and did so. And again, it was like Mary Martin or getting with FSG. I just landed with the agent of my dreams, mm-hmm. and I had no way of knowing that that was who it would be. I knew I liked her, but I had to go on faith and the sound of her voice and her enthusiasm. So I had a normal time of approaching agents, and then she sent it. We worked on it a little bit. Then she sent it out to publishers. You're supposed to give yourself 2 years. You're supposed to give yourself 100 agents before you give up. Then you're supposed to give yourself 2 years before you give up with publishers. But she sent out, they sent them out in groups of 10, and she sent them out the first batch in early fall, and one of those, most of them liked it, so to speak, very much, and were intrigued. Only one was interested in it, didn't even offer right away, but we ended up talking several times to about the book. I couldn't believe that these big hitters in New York were talking to me about my book and how they could see changes being made. I never got over that feeling that I was talking to Margaret Ferguson, who'd been out there a major leaguer for 37 years, and she knew my book inside and out and had some questions about it. Uh-huh. Well, that relationship grew, and they offered to buy it. The thing is, I think they needed to know, I'm guessing on this, but I think they needed to know that I was professional and that I was willing to make the changes they suggested, or had some good response. You know, a professional, here's, you know, I can fix that. Oh, that's good. I didn't see that. Or maybe that's a problem I have no idea about how to fix it. Just like a person to person, not one of these people who go, oh, you can't change a word of my book.
Yeah.
So I think that was the process of, because to tell you the truth, I don't think any book has ever sold on earth that needed as much work as my book did. And I think they needed to know that I would work on it.
Wow.
And change it and do it and shape it. And they always said, you don't have to do this, you don't have to do that. And there were things that I didn't change, but almost always, when they had a suggestion and they've been in the business forever, they were right. And one of the ways I could tell is because I would feel like I'd been caught. Trying to gloss over. I said, oh, I don't have to deal with that. I'll just gloss it over. Nobody will care. What about this character who does such and such? And I'm going, oh, well, I was hoping you wouldn't notice that. So they earned my trust. They really did earn my trust, and because of Margaret and Susan, Almost Paradise is a much better book.
Oh. Well, that, it's interesting to hear how you worked with your editor. I think you're right. A lot of authors, you know, by the time they send it out, they've worked on it so much, they think it's perfect, and they're insulted if somebody else wants to make a change.
There are awful lot of people who call it artistic integrity. Well, the truth is, you don't have to change anything. You've got your integrity. And my integrity is going nowhere. I'm listening to these people and making a decision whether they're right. Most of the time they were. And you know what? You can copy and save every draft. And if you rip it up and don't like it, that other one's sitting in your computer.
Right.
You can go back to it.
Right.
So I'd rip it up and try it and read it and play with it, and they made it better and better. I'm forever grateful that they gave me as much time as they did, because I do believe that editors are so overworked that they really would prefer getting a book that's closer to the mark.
Now, Corabelle, Almost Paradise is a book about a young girl who, kind of like your husband, is born grown up.
Yes.
Out of necessity.
Uh-huh.
Has to take care of the adults in her life and finds herself in quite an unusual situation. You want to tell us a little bit about where this story came from? Is it based on anything in particular, or did it just come out of your imagination?
Well, it is not autobiographical at all. There are some names and visions and colors and things that, of course, I remember from my life. But it is what I call a reverse coming of age story, because she has to take on the adult role, and she then, during this crisis, she has to find adults that she can trust and then learn to trust them. And in that way, she reclaims her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much the arc of her insight. She doesn't really know this, but that's what's going on. And I love your question about where ideas come from and inspiration and all of that, because almost everybody asks that question and wants to know the answer. Kids, adults, friends, everybody's sort of like, where did this come from? And when you think about it, that's an extremely funny question. as if ideas come from from UPS, wrapped up in brown paper, left on your doorstep. And that just tickles me. But the fact is, ideas come from the same idea that you go up front and ask, decide what to cook for dinner. Now, the reason, I do have something to say about where this idea comes from, and I've said it a few times, so it's getting a little stale in my mind, but it is still very true. Even though I'm repeating something, it's that this particular story came to me in a wave. And what happened was, I had been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and I was back in the bedroom with steroids and medicines and worried sick about what would happen to me, what would happen to my children. They were younger then. And I had a notepad and my computer, and I started scribbling, and it's just like the funniest thing. This character come bouncing in the room, and she's on the bed, and she says, "My name is Ruby Clyde Henderson, and I am not stupid. I look like a boy. Even at my age, I'm skinny, and as my mother says, flat as a pancake. So when I want, I tell people my name is Clyde, and when I don't want, it's Ruby. Some don't even believe I'm a girl with my hair being so short. It's funny. People tell you not to lie, but they hardly ever want to hear the truth. If you try to tell it, they call you a liar. Liar, liar, pants on fire. But if you lie, they believe you." And that was the first thing I wrote. And she was so forceful, Ruby Clyde was, that it the energy of that followed me through creating a story around her. Now, the story has been rewritten quite a few times, but Ruby Clyde is a healer, and she has this little saying, I can't remember the order, but she says something like, "I believe places can heal, I can believe people can heal, I can believe my hands can heal, and I believe science can heal, and you must use all of the above to get the maximum result." And I would add to that writing heals. Because after I did that first round of steroids, and I was writing this book, and this girl got inside of me, I just have ever since had an excellent prognosis. So in some sense, and of course, I do science, and I pray, and I do everything, but writing does heal me.
Wow. I mean, I know people have talked about that as in healing, psychological wounds, PTSD.
Yes.
But this
writing personal essays about your life is excellent. And something about the words on the page coming out of your deepest places is perfect. I don't know how it works, but it aids everything else that you're trying to do with your science. And my, I take all the medicines. I do real medicine, but this is special.
So you're going to keep doing it?
Writing?
Yes.
Oh, for heaven's sake! Yes, I write all the time, and this was just the most pronounced example. Another one was when I, it was just a few years ago, there was an episode of my family that was particularly bizarre, and I'm from Mississippi, so family can get way out there. I was put out with it, and there was nobody that I could go to fix it, because there was we're all grown now, so there's just like, what do you do when somebody just starts going off the rails? And I ended up writing an essay about that, because I was up in the mountains of North Carolina, and I wrote it, and it was the truest truth I could write. Mm. And after that, I wrote like 50 of them, because I had been the youngest child in a very loud and aggressive family, and funny and wacky. So I never really got my voice into that family, and I just started writing my view of everything that I'd never said. And I cannot tell you what that did for clearing my mind of clutter.
Wow. So did you show those essays to your family?
Some. I published maybe four of them, and I have shared others with others. They're not hateful at all, but I just kept trying to see and say what I knew. Mm. And so, yes, I mean, they're not secret, but what did Annie Lamont say? If you don't want me to write about you, you should have been nicer. So it's, but they're not hateful essays. They're just, when you're the youngest, you can often just watch people and try to think what they think and try to adopt what they are saying and doing and feeling, and that ain't good. Mm. So really the important thing is to sit down and know what you know, even if you're wrong. Knowing what you know helps. It's much better than trying to know what somebody else knows.
Wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I imagine that the editors were really surprised that you were willing to change so many things. Don't you think they were? Because they
Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux?
They said
yes. Yeah.
Yes. They didn't show surprise, but they called me a unicorn because I could do so much so fast, and I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know I could edit, period, and I didn't know that I could edit sort of book risky. You know, the book could have died taking out places and rearranging things like I did. But I think they're real good about not letting you know that they're afraid of you or anything. But I know I do think that they had to get that question answered before they made a contract with me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think they were relieved. Well, and they were surprised that I could do it quickly, and I was too. It used to be a comedy about a little girl whose mother's on death row, and the head of the acquisition said he didn't think that they could rally behind, that they could get teachers and librarians to rally behind such an odd concept. And I went to bed for a day or two in despair, because how do you take the death penalty out of a story about the death penalty? It was that big.
Oh, wow.
Son wrote me the best email. It's out on the internet everywhere. In most articles that I write about editing, I'll give a link to it. And he basically said, look, this is the profession. You got to do it if you want it out there. And if you don't want it out there, then you stay with your small group, and that's all good too. But he had done a documentary, which was an hour and a half long, and when they sold it to ESPN, they had to cut it down to the hour version, or 55 minutes, and he shared his story about how it felt to be cutting up the baby, and every little moment was precious, but then he said the steps, how he would do it. They would put their carts up there and change things and not change things and rearrange, and he said at the end, we had not lost anything. And we gained an audience of hundreds of thousands over our family.
Wow.
And he says, that's your choice. He says, I don't think that the spirit of Ruby Clyde is embodied in the death penalty aspect of the story. I think that Ruby Cloud is a standalone spirit, and as long as she survives, your book is there. So I would go, when I would make changes, I would read it over, the new stuff, and see if Ruby Cloud was still there, the important aspects. And sure enough, it was.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Korabel Schaffner, author of Almost Paradise. And, okay, so you've really got me curious about this. I was going to mention that, you know, the criminal justice system is something that you're sort of dealing with in this book.
Yes.
Is that something that's a very strong interest of yours? And because in this case...
I was a lawyer.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It is an interest. But it's also something I know a little bit about, so it's there.
Right. Right. And,
also,
you know, Korabel's mother is accused of a crime she didn't commit. And you really do show how people can be convicted even if they're not guilty.
Well, absolutely. And the justice system works in large part, but it's also immensely flawed because humans are flawed.
Right.
And that's something that in life, in every aspect of life, you've got to deal with humans messing it up. But one of the reasons I love this one, I didn't know this when I wrote it, there are 3 million children in this country who have incarcerated parents, and that's just children.
Oh my gosh.
Not to mention nieces, nephews, families, wives, everything else. There are only about 30 books for children that represent children with incarcerated parents.
Wow.
And so that is something that I can plug into joyfully to say this it would be good to represent this more and to contact other authors. And they can be from a picture book, what I've read, picture books of a young child, even without words, going to visiting day.
Mm.
Or they can be much more sophisticated for the older teenager that involves complexities or parents that are guilty and all of the things that those kids have to face. So there is a spectrum. Among those 30 to 40 books, there is a spectrum of experiences and age appropriateness in each group. So I wouldn't say that it would be a good thing to have more books in that category, because just the number, the 3 million children, they don't need to feel alone, and they don't need to feel ashamed, and they don't need to be ostracized, which does happen.
Yeah.
Now,
sure.
I was delighted recently. Oh, I wish I could say the name right now. Miss Mississippi contest was held recently, and my favorite contestant, she came in fourth. Her platform was to represent children with incarcerated parents.
Wow.
Never seen that in a platform. And my friend Belmont and I wanted her to win so much. We were cheering along and telling everybody to vote for her. But she did come in fourth, and often they'll come back and back a few years before they win. So I'm keeping my eye on her. She's beautiful, talented, and her father's been in jail for a long time, and she knows what she's speaking about. And I think that's something we could all agree on.
Oh, absolutely.
These children should be held close.
Korabel, why don't you read a little more from Almost Paradise?
Okay. I will tell you that what I read earlier was the original opening. And you took it to workshop with Jill McCorkle and Richard Bowship at Swanee. And Jill said, you know, I like that opening. It's funny. It's lively. She says, but I like a story that opens up in the middle of an action. Mm-hmm. So instead of just Ruby Cloud bouncing around saying, this is who I am, I rewrote it to this new beginning where you don't even learn her name for a few pages. It goes like this now.
Okay.
I woke up alone in the back seat of the catfish's car. That was my mother's boyfriend. Don't get me started on the catfish. his real name was Carl, but I called him the catfish because that's exactly what he looked like. The distance between his eyes was enormous, and he had skinny lips and a pointy mustache. If I'd been older when he came around, I never would have allowed him into our lives. But honest to God, I had no entire clue how to get rid of him once he was wedged into our family. You may as well know, Mother was no help at all, but don't hold that against her. She'd been real fragile. Wait a minute, lost my place. She'd been real fragile since my father died, which was before I was born. I'm still inside Mother at the time, and his shooting death actually made me come out. Anyway, Catfish wasn't in the car, neither was my mother. The sun was all over me, and I was tangled up in the blanket, staring up at the ceiling. Thumbtacks held up the saggy material. And you know, at first I didn't even wonder where I was born. I mean, I knew I was in the Catfish's car, but to think outside the car would be like wondering where my planet was in the universe. I sat up to look for Mom. She was just outside, sitting on an upturned log by a burning campfire, watching coffee perk into the glass knob on top of the metal pot. A lady holding a carton of milk sat on the log beside Mother. I thought she was the nurse from school with those blonde curls around her face. Then I realized I'd never seen her before. It still hadn't hit me how much we were not home. Really, really not at home. I rested my cheek on the window and watched Mother watch the coffee brew. She sat real dainty with her feet and knees together. My mother was always a pretty person, even in the morning. Her hair was thick and wavy around the shoulders of her favorite dress. She kept herself real clean, too, which was something I could stand to learn. What's more, she was calm, being outside and all, so I knew Catfish was nearby. Mother's almost like those agora-something people on TV, the ones who can't go out of the house, but she's not mentally ill. There's no medical words ending in oids or icks for what she was. It's just that after my father died, she stayed inside so much, she forgot how to get along in the world. It all seems like chaos to her, she said. The catfish got to her to go outside more, but so what? We didn't need it. Speaking of outside, we were surrounded by those big RV tents and pop-up campers all under the trees. It was organized somehow like an outdoor hotel, and then I started to think, where the heck are we? I went to sleep at home and woke up in some kind of vagabond camp. Inside the car was all packed up. That should have told me something. It was stuffed full of my toys, workbooks, clothes, and two horrible orange lamps. Looked like all our belongings, but that didn't upset me right away. I only got upset when I tried to get out of the car and put my foot down on a flimsy box. As soon as I felt the cardboard crush, my heart sank. My birthday cake. I had stepped on my birthday cake, the one I'd bought for myself at the grocery store, the one my friend Bonnie and I were supposed to share at home that afternoon for my 12th birthday. Mother could never celebrate my birthday because of Father and all, but I couldn't figure out what my cake was doing there on the back seat of the back seat floor of the Catfish's car. I pulled up the box in my lap and lifted the busted top. Inside it said P. Day Ubi. I cried. I was no crybaby, but I was so surprised to wreck my own name that the tears just leaked out. Half in birth could fall by the wayside, but losing the R from Ruby, now that hurt. It hurt bad. I knew from the Bible that when somebody got a name change, God was about to let it rip. So I knew then, just sitting and looking at that Ubi, that even though it was only my 12th birthday, my life was turning upside down. So that was how changed it.
Well, that I can see, yeah, that is a more in the middle of things.
Yes, and while before you know her name, for three pages in, you see her mother, the catfish, her little history, a little bit of her history with her father, the place that she's been pulled out of bed and taken on the road.
Mm-hmm.
You just get a little bit of her entire situation instead of just who she is.
And you know, this probably happens to more children than you realize. They're uprooted and away they go. You know, and they don't have any say.
Well, that's right. And there's so many children who have got fragile parents, and they're doing the adult thing. I don't know if I've got time to tell you one more piece. In this, one of her main messages is pieces of love. and she's talking to her aunt in the hospital.
Yes.
And she finds pieces of love. And she's talking about, her aunt is saying, how could you live with your mother? She's got these problems. And Ruby Claus says, everything is so mixed up, you can't wait around for perfect. You just have to love what you get. You only get to love pieces of people. Mother has problems, but she loves me. And she says, if you wait around for perfect, you'll end up getting nothing. So part of that is how she stays resilient, is not letting other people's flaws drag her down into hate or self-loathing.
Yeah. That would be, and it's easy to do, you know, it's easy, especially for a child who's dependent on a parent and idolizes that parent and tries to do what, tries to be like that parent, and then they're so confused because they go, what are we doing, you know?
Yes, yes. And if you live long enough, you will certainly find that you actually love people who say and do despicable things in another place.
Mm-hmm.
It's a heck of a place to be, is to know that you love this spirit sitting in front of you, and they are, in another part of their life, they are bad, bad, bad.
Wow, I never really thought about that, but it's true.
Well, it's true. You've got parents who are alcoholics.
Right.
You've got a love-hate thing going on there. You got a paradox.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Mom, did you have some questions?
Well, what I did was, because I had to read this book, 2 weeks ago?
Right, yeah. Right.
So I wrote down the people, the characters in it. And that lady that helped her find her aunt, I thought that was a piece of love, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And she was added late. And you know why she was added?
No.
Because Farrar Straff and Drew would not let me let Ruby hitchhike. Because originally Ruby was hitchhiking and she was a little Huck Finn just going out into the horizon all the time. Well, that was the last piece of hitchhiking that needed. I had to get her from the filling station up into the hill country.
Uh-huh.
And they're in New York, and they're saying, well, can't she call a cab?
Yeah.
Can't she get a bus? And I've got, no, no, no. Then it occurred to me to have her meet a very, very pleasant, reliable person at the campsite who then shows up and helps her.
Mm.
That solved that problem. But I can't tell you how many times I rewrote it trying to get them to let her hitchhike.
Wow.
But again, it works fine. I'm glad you liked that because...
Yeah, it really does.
One of the last big changes.
You know, it would have taken if she had hitchhiked, she would have met a whole plethora of other people, you know, other characters.
Yes, and she did. In an earlier draft, there were quite a few chapters about the journey to the hill country, and they felt like the story... That bogged down the middle, that they wanted to get her on to Paradise Ranch.
Oh, yeah,
sure. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. But I talked to my editor and said, I don't see what the big deal is about hitchhiking. And she took a long breath and she says, I bet you were a fun mother. And I said, no, I would let my children hitchhike. But I did hitchhike quite a bit, but I wasn't 12 years old.
Well, you know, back in the day, hitchhiking was not so dangerous. And
and I hitchhiked back in the 70s,
uh-huh.
And it was dangerous. I had a friend who was murdered, but it wasn't perceived as dangerous. And I had the idiocy of a child with magical thinking that I could see if someone was a murderer. So I talked to him a little bit before I got in the car, like I could spot Ted Bundy ahead of time. I lived, and people slowly stopped hitchhiking.
Yeah, well, I was thinking 40s and 50s. That's back in my day.
Yes.
You know, kids used to hitchhike back and forth to college and stuff, you know. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And soldiers were everywhere getting picked up. People loved giving them rides.
Oh, yeah.
But I just stepped out there. A friend told me, he said, look at this. You can stick out your thumb. They'll pick you up and take you wherever you want or wherever they're going. And that I just left doing that. It was so fun. But it was dangerous. I lived in Germany in the early 70s, and it never frightened me.
Now, Corbel, why did you decide to set this in the Hill Country, which is just outside of Austin?
The Hill Country. I spent summers there. I consider myself part Texan. I grew up out there, and when I started writing, it just became the place for Ruby to find healing. And I mean, really, have you been up there?
Oh yeah,
like Israel. It's like Israel. It's got rocks and dirt and these twisty trees, and everything is so gorgeous and peaceful and dramatic.
Oh yeah,
and I really spent a lot of time there, and the deep love I had for it gave it a play, gave me an extra boost in having her heal there.
Mm-hmm. I was just
when a vulture sails up, the big black thing sails up into the swirl of air and disappears into the sky over the hills, and it just takes my breath away even to think of it. The small things up there that are gorgeous.
I was just at the Perdinale Falls 2 weeks ago and Krause Springs last weekend. Mm. I don't know if you're familiar with either of those. But
Yes, and I had just done a six-week drive around Texas before launch because I wanted to reconnect to all of Texas. And, oh, my goodness. And I saw places I'd never seen, like down by Galveston, and I'd never been to Corpus Christi. I spent most of my time in the Hill Country, San Antonio, Austin, but I made a huge loop all around. I love that state. Mm. When my daughter went out to camp, the third generation to go out to the Guadalupe River in the Hill Country, she met a 103-year-old cowgirl who was still riding horses and leading the riding department.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
And she'd been there. She taught me. She taught my mother. So that, to me, when you think about Connie Reeve, the way she was as a cowgirl, that, to me, is the spirit of Texas.
Wow. And it was fun for me because I was in Austin while I was reading this. And so when you talk about different places or even when they came into town, into the courthouse or to the attorney's apartment, I sort of... I think, do you have a reference to the bats? I think you might talk about the bats a little bit.
Did you see the bats?
I have seen the bats. I haven't seen them recently. I keep meaning to go down there because my condo's right downtown on Barton Springs Road.
When are you going to invite me?
No, well, I will do that after my daughter. My daughter's staying there now, and once she gets her own place, I'll have room. So I'll let you know. Do you know Austin Java and Uncle Billy's right there on Barton Springs Road?
Barton Place
is the condo right behind there.
But we can go up into the hills and go all the way out to hunt, and I'll show you some good things.
Oh, that would be
now,
fun.
I'm actually going in middle September with my best friends, Belmont and Deborah, because they have put me, when we were children, they put me on the bus every summer for 8 years, and I would go away to Texas, Hill Country. And the camp has, some years ago, they started this Waldemar Women's Week, so you can go back as an adult, and you can, like, make lanyards and canoe and have martinis. You couldn't do when you were a camper. But my best friends, we're all going to go out there in September and have, they're going to see where I was all those years.
Oh, what
fun. Anybody who's been there loves it.
Well, did you ever see the parrots? Monica saw the parrots. I can't get over that.
There's wild parrots that have colonized basically along Lady Bird Lake.
Wait a minute. I've got to write this down. Yeah. Are they in Austin?
They're in Austin. And one day I'm just walking down. I was walking down towards the river, and there's this tree full of parrots. And I stop and stare at it, and everybody else is just walking by because they're all used to it. They're bright green. And there's a ton of them.
Oh no! I'm writing that down. I'm gonna go there next time. I know the bats.
I knew you.
Well, all kinds of things, but parrots. Oh my goodness! Yeah.
I knew you'd like that.
Yeah, I'm a sucker. You can tell what kind of things I like.
And pigs. So, was there always a pig in the story?
Yes, because one time years and years and years ago, I was going through hot springs, and somebody told me to go to a place called the IQ Zoo, and it didn't exist at the time, but there was kind of a little animal show somewhere that was just pathetic, and I always remembered that. So right at the first of Ruby Claw's adventures, she goes to the fictional IQ Zoo, and one thing leads to another, so they steal that pig who's driving the little Cadillac because it's inhumane, and she doesn't actually do it. The mother's very upset by it, and she goes to, she tells the bad catfish boyfriend to go get the pig, so he does. And then Ruby has that pig from the beginning until the end when the Bunny the pig, he's growing up.
Yeah, they do that.
As he gets larger, as Ruby outgrows her boots and gets blisters and needs new clothes, the pig is also growing, and she realizes that he needs to find a home out there, which would be better for him than following her on the next adventure in homes and cities.
So, speaking of which, is Ruby Clyde going to make a further appearance?
I don't think that I can give her any better obstacles than what she's had here.
Mm.
So, she's always available for something, but I do see using the Hill Country, I see using Aunt Eleanor in a much earlier time, almost as a main character, and I have thought of using Ruby in another place, but I'm not sure I can make it as critical. I mean, she can't have that many crises.
Mm, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then it would just be rude to stamp out Ruby Claw's stories. But it's always possible because people love her dearly.
Oh, yeah. Now, what kind of reaction have you gotten from kids her age to the story?
You know, if you're an adult, your first readers are all adults, and so I'm always aware when they talk about how much they love it and get good reviews and stuff like that, or I'm thinking, oh, but these are all still adults. But I've started in with the kids, and it's so touching. It's the most touching thing in the world for a child to say how moving the story is, or how they want to be writers. Mm. And they're just such little bunnies. They come up and hug you, and I love them. But I can't wait to get into the schools, because part of the kidlit world is to go into the schools and talk to children. So I look so forward to going face to face with young readers who have experienced Ruby Claw. But they like it so far because it's got a lot of oomph right from the beginning, and then it's got a lot of feels. It's got a lot of humor, and then down to the sadness and back to the humor. So they're liking it so far.
Well, Corbell, if you come down to Austin and stay with me, will you go to my daughter-in-law's school and talk to
the
kids? She teaches third grade, and I know that there are children in her class that are in this situation.
Mm. Oh, you know it.
Yeah.
You know it. And secrets just magnify the pain and the damage.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who is that, Monica?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. When you come that way, I know I'm going to go down to, I'll probably go everywhere, but the San Antonio bookstore has asked to set a date.
Mm.
So I'll definitely get in touch, and then we're coming out there. And actually, you ought to come with us to Waldemar Women's Week. It's a hoot.
When is it?
Well, it's in the middle of September.
Well, I am going to be in Europe in the middle of September, but otherwise I would love to.
Where are your priorities?
Yeah, really.
She's a world traveler.
I'm taking my mother to Europe for the first time and to see her grandson become ordained as a deacon at St. Peter's in the in Vatican City.
They're Catholic.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Because there was a big thing. It used to be that everybody would think that Sister Eleanor was Catholic, and I kept saying she's an Episcopalian nun, and giving as many things right up front that she was a Catholic, because she's so loosey goosey, and it's right the Catholic nuns can't do these things that she did.
I didn't know that Episcopalians had nuns.
Oh yeah.
Well, they do, yeah. and it's. Some are more formal than others, but as usual with Episcopalians, we have a great variety of things. You know, you can get in, you can get out, and you can wear whatever you want, and you know, all the things that Sister Eleanor does.
And Aunt Eleanor is supported by a retired football player. Did I get that right?
Well, he's one of those big old Christians that does media and sports, but he's a grand person, and he shares his wealth. One of the ways he shares his wealth is allowing the solitary nuns to live on their on his property.
Mm.
And so that's why she's able to be in that beautiful little cottage in the peach orchard by herself. Now, once I was in up there in that area, my sister was sick and dying, and there was a nun nearby who was Episcopalian, and she was solitary. I thought she was silent, but she was solitary, and everything about her fascinated me. This is 20 years ago. Fascinated me beyond belief. And then I had no other way to get in touch with her, but I was able to find another nun in that same framework, and I asked her all the questions to say, can you do this, or could this man have done that, or can you decide not to be a nun and stop, and all the things to make her grounded in reality.
Mm.
And that was good. But I so much remember that I can't remember if it's in the final version of the book, but I remember Sister Bridget was just coming back from a convention of silent nuns in Sweden, and I just thought that was the funniest thing.
Absolutely. Well, we are about out of time.
Yes.
So I just want to thank you so much.
We'll talk offline.
It was so much fun having you.
Oh, listen, I wanted to say one more thing. You're doing this mother-daughter thing is so wonderful to me. And the theme, one of the themes throughout this book is mother-daughter relationships or mother-child relationships. Even Ruby and her piglet and the sisters and their mother and the sisters and their children. So I love that you're doing this online, on the radio.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. And it's thank you so much for being with us today. And Mom, do you have some closing words?
I do. This kind of fits. It is not required that one be perfect in order to help others. And I think that fits Ruby perfectly.
And stay tuned now if you're listening on Friday for Planet Earth's Wild. This show is rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. Also check out writersvoices.com and see you next week on Writers Voices.
Thank you so much.
Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU-LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUU-FM.com and writersvoices.com.